All right, so I came to North Dakota State in 1994 after working with Ted Peck on a sampling project from 89 to 93 and getting my PhD. And they hired me in spite of my precision ag, corn, soybean, and tile drainage background. And now all I talk about is site-specific farming, corn, soybeans, and tile drainage management. So it's changed quite a little bit. North Dakota is kind of an epicenter of site-specific. So I want to, you might not think that all this has to do with nutrient management, but I'm going to convince you it is, and that it does all play a role. So I'm going to be talking about all of these things in very short little segments. So the reason that we have any site-specific nutrient management is because of the integration of three things that appeared about the same time in the late 1980s. The release of GPS by the Department of Defense, the personal computer that was cheap enough for people to afford, and then a couple of visionaries, Loral and AgChem, their CEOs, decided that variable rate application would be a good thing. And all came together about the same time, and it was not off the shelf, but people struggled with it and made it work. I'm going to rely a lot on this presentation in a 2016 survey, USDA survey by Schimmelfennig, and it's available online. It's a really interesting survey. It surveyed over 1,000 farms across the United States, and some of the results I'll share with you today. So GPS guidance, just farmers in the survey that use GPS guidance compared to those farmers in the survey that didn't, their net profits are about 2.5% higher than farmers that didn't. One of the reasons for this, as far as the nutrient management goes, is just being able to direct fertilizer applicators so that it actually spreads fertilizer where you think it's going to be spread. This field is a 12.5 hectare a field that Ted Peck and I worked on, and he worked on it for like 40 years. In the early days, they put really heavy amounts of P and K on the field, and they're streaking, which is exactly the width of the applicator apart. Really high P levels, and in between, really low P levels. So before GPS guidance, this is just common. And the residual effect in some fields still exists today. So a couple of different sources, net return from GPS costs with 1 centimeter accuracy, $2,380 a hectare, just having a light bar, GPS guidance. This is some work by Griffin and Jeslo and Berg de Boer, who apparently is going to work in England now. Anyway, the profitability from this came from reduced hours of tillage because you're not going over the same land. You know, you're not overlapping or anything like that. It's just an efficiency factor. But then if you factor in the savings from not overlapping your seed and your fertilizer and your pesticides, the average reduction of inputs was about 5%. And if you were paying somewhere around $500 a hectare for those inputs, that's $25 a hectare savings just in products. I don't know if you've ever been in a strip-till machine, but strip-till would not be practical if it wasn't for this. And so thinking about soil conservation and ways to make no-till effective in row crops that have higher temperature expectations like corn, that centimeter accuracy GPS is just critical. It's impossible without it. Tony Vine published that the no-till systems typically are going to be somewhere around 5% less in yield than those in conventional till, but with strip-till there's no difference in return from them. And so the advantage of having that centimeter accuracy related to strip till is somewhere around $100 a hectare. Another more recent thing, maybe in the last 6-10 years, something like that, is this individual planter box, boom spray, shutoffs. Those of you that don't farm square, rectangular fields and have potholes like we do in North Dakota to go around and hillsides and irregular field boundaries like there are in the east before we had the land grant system in the Great Plains, all of those point rows just eat up inputs. And this is a huge savings in seed, fertilizer, pesticides. And at Tennessee studies, savings are anywhere from a tenth of a percent to 15% in some fields. So the savings from seed alone would be $10 to $25 a hectare, depending on the size and shape. So that's the background of that. So then we go into actually sampling for the nutrients. And it is not possible to just walk into a field and not know anything about it and know that you're going to make money with a site-specific nutrient application. There's no way of knowing it. You know, the way to know it is to do the adequate grid or zone sampling, depending on where the variability is. And then even if there's variability in the field, is the variability in a range, and that range of values where doing something about it is actually going to make some economic sense. So there's no slam dunk that if you do variable rate that you're going to get a profit. So grid sampling, thing that people have trouble thinking about. They're always thinking about how much per acre is this grid sampling going to cost. And when I started in 94, we had a group of from a fertilizer company north of Fargo come in and say, we want to do grid sampling. We've got this variable rate machine that we've ordered, and we want to do grid sampling. What do we need to do? And I told them a sample an acre, and they had a heart attack. And when they recovered, they decided that, you know, I suppose we could afford one sample every 5 acres. We one sample every 2.5, you know, 2 hectares. And I said, well, that's fine, but it's not going to do what you think it's going to do. And that's when the excitement and then the crash, because they found out it wasn't what they wanted to do, and then we picked it up from there. So anyway, right now, you know, we have the GPS and we have the computer programs, and we can do the systematic underlying grid, so it eliminates all of those systematic errors we have in sampling that we used to have before we had GPS, where you just follow the row down, and if you were in one of those high P strips from the overlap, it looked like that side of the field was fine, and really it wasn't. And so the systematic underlying grid that most people grid sample with now, that doesn't eliminate it, but it makes it a rare thing that you get into one of those strips and follow it the length of the field. But the density is the problem. Most of the grid sampling, especially in the Corn Belt in the U.S., is done about one sample a hectare, one sample every 2.5 acres, and that's okay for a lot of people, because in the I states they've had a history for 40, 50 years of build-up maintenance, and so their P levels are almost always high. There's variability, but who cares, because it's all in the same recommendation range, and so 2.5 acres work for them. It's an educational struggle in North Dakota, where we never had a build-up maintenance program, and everything is related to relief, which I'll show in a minute, and to try to talk people out of a 2.5 acre grid, because in that situation, you need a sample an acre grid in order to reveal those patterns in the field. If you don't do that, you might as well be on the moon, because it's not going to look like your field. So that brings us to this. I didn't really think about zone sampling or in that manner at all in Illinois. I mean, I came out of the grid sampling tradition, and when I came to North Dakota, I just figured we need to sample an acre. In North Dakota, it would be too expensive, because we sampled to 2 to 4 feet and 60 to 120 centimeters for nitrate, and it'd be too expensive, and that'd be the end of that. And found out that wasn't the case. So this is a 12.5 hectare field, 60 miles west of Fargo, and it has a cute little horse head pattern in the middle of it. And I thought, well, that's cool. We'll never see it again, because nitrate moves. And then for the next 10 years, I saw the horse head in the field. You know, those nitrate patterns were stable, and it just, you know, that second year it just hit me. I was like, we could do this by relief. We could do this by zone. We could take 3 or 4 composite samples out of the field, and we'd have that thing nailed. And so that's when our zone program began. And it's all related to topography. The horse head is in between swales and the landscape. Those were the areas that were kind of medium in nitrate, but anyway, they're well defined. The ridges are sandy and leachable, and then there's areas in the field where the nitrate accumulates. So it's all related to landscape. We've found that, and we should have known this, but mobile nutrients move, but they always move to the same places. And so, you know, the absolute value of the nitrate, or, you know, if we ever get a soil test that actually does anything for sulfate, you know, it'll detect that too, or chloride. Any of those mobile nutrients always move to the same place, but the absolute value is different. You have to sample for them. So we use different tools. We've used the Veris EC detector where we have a lot of rocks. We've used this, and O'Neill's worked with this a lot in Missouri. It does different things for different people. In some places, it delineates areas that have higher clay or lower clay or a limiting layer underneath, and so everything else is kind of low, and this one thing stands out like your limiting layer. In North Dakota, it's kind of a pattern detector because we have soluble salts, and they overlap into varying clay contents and various moisture contents because of landscape position. So all of those things, so it's a pattern detector for us. Remote imaging. The photograph on the left is from a 5,000 feet, just straight down from an airplane, and the image on the right, it's that same field. You can see the horse head in the middle if you don't look too hard. It's that same field of Valley City, one of the years that we were working with it. So these patterns are visible from other places. A yield monitor, you can nail those if it's just the right year, but we really encourage people to do multi-year yield maps because 1 year, it may not look like another year. So multi-year yield maps, and Frank Casey worked a lot with that, and we have a nice circular. So the bottom line on how to sample is that zone sampling works for us in fields that have lower fertility, that haven't been built up maintenance over many years, that haven't been heavily manured, haven't been fertilized aggressively, and grid sampling works better on fields that have been fertilized heavily. But unless the values are all in that same fertilizable range, sample in acres where you got to be. You know, that value comes out of Wisconsin, it comes out of North Dakota, it comes out of Nebraska, it comes out of any state that ever did that horrible, hard, sweaty, horrible grid sampling work back in the 90s. All right. So, what difference does it make? In this survey, out of all those 1,000 farms, the net profit from people that use variable rate technology was about 1.1% higher than those that didn't use it. In the Red River Valley, Minnesota, North Dakota, a recent survey of sugar beet farmers, which is a fairly high profitable crop, although, you know, with 300 bushel corn, I think the profit in that is pretty close to what it is in sugar beet production. But the profit from our variable rate application averaged over 10 years, $120 per hectare. So it's been a slam dunk. So because of that, in the Red River Valley of Minnesota and North Dakota, about 53-54% of the sugar beet acres, the sugar beet areas, the region, was variable rate in 2016. And this is really lower than the investigation of it, because what a lot of farmers will do, and their consultants, is they'll go out and do a composite test of a field. They'll put, you know, 15-20 cores in a bucket, have it analyzed, and if the value is very low, that means there's not much variability in the field, and they'll just go with a uniform application. If the nitrate values are higher, above a certain amount, maybe 40, 50 pounds an acre, $100-$125 a hectare, then they'll pay the extra money to do a zone sampling on it, and they'll fertilize. So the amount of areas that are screened for this are in excess of 80% of all the sugar beet acres in the valley. So zone sampling, then, of course, is not all of it, because when first started talking about grids and zones and all that, we don't have these discussions at this conference anymore, but people were saying, well, we have small-scale variability. Dr. Bill Ron, in his work at Oklahoma State, one of the reasons that he decided to go a different route is because the small-scale variability in Oklahoma was meters, not you know, 30, 40 meters, but it was meters. And so about half the variation in the field is described by something like a zone or an anechoic grid. So what about the other? So this is These are a couple instruments that people use, the Green Seeker, the Crop Circle Sensor. There's others. You might recognize one of those people in there. And so that's one way to get an in season. And that's why I didn't get straight A's in grade school. They made me take art. But the whole idea of it, if you're new to it, and I don't think many of you are, is you're doing the sensing on the right side and you're doing the squirting on the left side. And so you're gathering the data. You have a reference area in the field, and then that's your standard. And so you take your readings against the standard. You predict a yield, and then the rest of the field, you have another yield, and if it's a lot different, then that's what you use in order to figure it out. Oklahoma State's tried to do some economics on this thing, but there's very few people that have really done economics on this, and so it's really in the infancy of trying to gather whether these things are really going to give you an economic return. It's really just, so that leads us to drones. Let's say that you're a farmer and you have 60 fields. And you go across a field and you never turn the instrument on because all of your readings are about the same. I think after a couple fields like that, you wonder why in the world you're doing this at all. And so I think drones would be most valuable if they get to the point where they can be flown on ahead of your variable rate decision in season in order as a logistic tool to screen out fields that actually need it and maybe make an estimate of the area that actually needs the fertilizer and get an idea of how many tons of fertilizer you need to use in a field. So I think this is where this is going to be most valuable. So to summarize, the use of any of these is not a guarantee to profitability. If there's variability of nutrients that are in the field and they're in the range where it's going to do you some good to address it, then there can be a profit. The bottom line is that overall in this large survey by Schimmelfennig, he indicated that the use of any of these precision technologies resulted in about $165 per acre or per hectare advantage net return over farms that didn't use any of the technologies. And interestingly enough, North Dakota was the lead state in return, economic return of these, despite being hired because it would never work in North Dakota. The return by North Dakota farmers was $224 per hectare. Thank you.